All right, we're going to turn now to our first interview of the morning with Phil McCabe. Welcome to the studio, Phil.
Good morning, Aaron. Thank you.
Are we talking about the fast track first?
Let's.
Okay. Does everyone know that seabed mining is on the fast track? I'm sure everyone knows that by now.
It is on the fast track process. It was included in the government's fast track list of projects, 140-odd projects, and the seabed mining was listed in there, and they've applied to the EPA, the Environmental Protection Authority, through that fast track process. And actually the process of considering their application has begun.
So apply when you say the EPA, that sounds like what's happened before, where the EPA has turned them back regularly. But this, I don't think this is going to be the same.
Well, the EPA, the same organisation, assesses the application, but it's under a different law, a completely different law, being the Fast Track Approvals Act, which the Fast Track Approvals Act has economic benefit or economic growth as its primary purpose of the Act. So it's the overarching objective of the Act is to build economic growth, whereas the previous law that it was assessed under was the Exclusive Economic Zone Act, which looked at the environmental implications as the primary consideration. So it's basically shifting the purpose of the decision or the hierarchy of...
The environment and the future generations are lower on the list.
That's right.
And it would have, and also the definition of economic benefits, like I don't see huge economic benefits to having a foreign corporation heading off with all the profits, but I doubt that they look at that because that doesn't seem like their style.
If this could be done, you know, without too much environmental damage, which it can't at this point in time, you'd think to get the biggest economic benefit, you know, the nation might look at doing it, and you know, but it's a foreign company, and most of the profits would go there, and yeah, it's the worst economic model that you could imagine the way it's set up at the moment.
Okay, fabulous. So what are we waiting for to happen? What's the next thing?
I believe the application went in a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago. The EPA has ticked the first box, which is this application is complete. We'll now appoint a decision-making committee. So they'll appoint five decision-makers to read the application and consider it, and then they may or may not have a hearing. So, and there's a process in between all of this where the parties that are able to engage in the process, which are limited to local iwi and local councils. Previously, anyone within the country could submit and be a party to the application and express their views and bring their expertise to the decision-making process, but we've all been cut out.
So South Taranaki say they want to participate, the district council, but they've applied, so it doesn't sound like they can just submit, they have to apply for permission to submit, is the kind of the feeling I got from the wording?
Yeah, the yes. It's a little bit unclear that the South Taranaki, you'd think that the South Taranaki District Council would be automatically, you know, deemed a relevant party to engage. Yeah. You'd also think the same for Taranaki Regional Council, Whanganui District Council, and possibly New Plymouth District Council, although they're around the coast some distance. And also Horizons Regional Council, those councils.
Where is Horizons?
Horizons runs, sort of, I guess the Taranaki Regional Council goes down to somewhere near Pātea, Whanganui, that area, and then Horizons takes it down through toward Wellington, Kapiti.
Okay, so that living coast
that kind
of thing.
That stretch of coast, yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, that comes, the reason for that, them to be involved, I think, would be because the plume may travel down that far to Whanganui and possibly beyond, and you know the interconnectivity of the marine environment and this potential flow and effects to their area.
Yeah. So, and that, are we confident that they're going to be listened to?
So CASM has sort of considered, looked at the list of potential decision makers that could be on the committee, and we're not dissatisfied with the list of people there, and we have a sense that the EPA will do a reasonable job.
But does the government have to listen to them?
Well, yes, the decision will come. It'll make a decision, and the government can't, you know, they can't leapfrog a decision out of the EPA. The company, if it's declined through the EPA, the company, TTR, could potentially appeal to the High Court and go through that whole appeals process, and vice versa. If it's approved through the EPA, then CASM, well, not CASM, unless...
Yeah.
So the iwi and the councils could appeal as well. There is a hook here, and CASM has written to the EPA. The EPA has discretion to decide who might have interest greater than the general public to engage, and we feel, CASM feels, that we have engaged in this process for many years, and with the TTR previous applications and so on, and we've been an appellant all the way to the Supreme Court, that we have, you know, an interest greater than the general public. So, and in that regard, we would have we've written to the EPA asking for, you know, the ability to engage in the process. We don't know what the answer will be around that, but
so the test for that, like the EPA has been given criteria for who
they have some discretion to make that decision,
but general public is ruled out.
You and I as individuals wouldn't be able to.
The other thing too is that with the Minister Shane Jones out in public saying all sorts of stuff, and the government striking a belligerent attitude about this. Even though that's not written in, that's not policy, and it's not guidelines, it does have an effect, because the whole point of a government structure is to be a hierarchy and for the wishes of the people at the top, for their wishes to be carried out. And you can see it in things like, I've heard people talk about the change in culture and wins depending on who the government is,
right,
like work and income. And when it's someone brutal like Paula Bennett, used to be the minister, then her vibe goes through the organisation and people get treated like crap.
So
I'm expecting that to be in the mix somewhere. You can't quantify it, but...
Possibly, Aaron. I think, you know, that culture can change, you know, but Shane Jones is the Minister for Minerals and he's the Minister for Oceans and Fisheries. The EPA falls under the Environment portfolio, so... and the EPA is an independent organisation, and... I think that we believe that the EPA isn't overly happy with the fast track law, because it does override the other laws within which the EPA typically acts under. So,
yeah,
the people that put their hand up to work in those places, they're generally, you know, the bulk of them are generally going to have a desire to do good by the environment. I might be looking at this half glass full, but
I can see them thinking, "What's the point of us being here if they're going to make laws to override
our
decisions?
Our underlying purpose, right?"
Yeah,
it's I think the PA will do a fair job, and if they do, then the application should be declined. There is the challenge though around that higher purpose of the law, which is to enable economic activity, and, you know, weighing up environment versus economic activity isn't a happy process, and usually the environment loses. But
you've got the fishing industry here. Like, is there fishing in the South Taranaki Bight?
There is.
So presumably they take into account the damage to that economic sector.
Yeah, the possibility of damage to that. The fishing industry, we understand, has now said that they have requested to participate in the application process as well, just as CASM has. The fishing industry arguably may have a stronger case for that, because they are they do represent people who are active in industry in that area, so
they represent people who National Party respects.
Well, that's right, and you know, so I imagine they'll get a seat at the table, and the fishing industry has opposed this forever because they understand that it will damage the environment, which underpins their industry. You know,
so speaking of the environment, which the CEO of TTR has said it's a desert out there. And what did Shane Jones say recently?
Shane Jones said last week that it is a bog standard seabed.
And yeah. So he strikes this belligerent, funny guy pose for his supporters, 7% of the population.
He talks directly to his people, and they love it. You know, they love it. But not all of them, because we've met people in Pātia that are part of the fishing club down there, and they, you know, a couple of them are like, yeah, we're New Zealand First supporters.
Right.
But, you know, they're not happy about this at all. So Shane Jones is losing votes through this, I reckon. And so is National. They've both, you know, stepped into this and supported this without having the background knowledge of how their own voters in the area feel about it. It's broad spectrum.
Yeah.
The political landscape across this issue is everybody. There's almost no one that supports this in the region, and that's come out really strongly in the last period of time.
Actually, that's interesting. Who is? Can we name anyone who supports it?
Philip Brown is a shareholder who lives in New Plymouth. He's a businessman, and he gets his way with the Taranaki Daily News.
He's a shareholder in TTR.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
so you have to be at that level. I mean, it makes sense that he would support it because he stands to gain financially.
Yeah.
No one else in the entire region.
Like, pretty much. And I mean, so the South Taranaki District Council voted last year or the year before, we unanimously opposed seabed mining. Whanganui District Council did the same earlier this year. South Taranaki just reaffirmed that the other day. New Plymouth District Council, there was a hearing or a presentation by a Whanganui councillor last week, and the chambers got filled up with people.
The chambers and the room next door as well,
correct.
I saw.
And the same happened in South Taranaki.
So their councils, can I just ask, because our council, we feel like we shouldn't be part of Waikato District Council because there's these other towns over there, Huntly and Narawahia, and we probably like the people there, but we don't feel like we're part of that. We don't feel like we're certainly part of the north part of the district.
And
we don't feel like we're part of the rural in a way. And I feel like there's a psychological disconnect, whereas we're down that way in Taranaki. I feel like there's not these other centres. The centres are on the coast.
Well, we're probably the biggest centre on the coast. For the Waikato
for the district, yeah, but I'm comparing our council to those councils.
Sure.
Where you've got your cities are on, your big centres are on the coast, and I think people...
Look, the centre of the world is right here, Aaron. Raglan's the centre of the world.
Well, this is true, it's true.
But Lisa Thompson reached out to me the other day, just sort of expressing her concern around this, and she pointed out that the Waikato District Council coastal area is from Aotea in the south to Port Waikato in the north. So there's a significant stretch of coast that the Waikato District Council... should have concern over, and you know, I think it wouldn't hurt. It would be a good expression from the Waikato District Council to voice their opposition, their solidarity with the Taranaki councils, because remember that the first application or the first prospecting permit for seabed mining in New Zealand waters was directly off the Maunga here, and Whai Angeline Greensill stood up and opposed and brought the issue to the community 20 years ago, and that was the beginning of Chasm. So, and back in the day, there was exploration permits from Whanganui all the way to Cape Reinga, unbroken line of permits.
Yeah.
So this is like the first sort of Trojan horse into possibly the entire coast opening up for this activity. And
it does open a door if it starts
somewhere
else on the coast. And I interviewed Lisa Thompson on Friday, and she hasn't done anything formally yet within the council, but she's embarking on that, I think. And I know from the way she talked about on and off the air, she's taking it seriously.
Yeah, I mean, she should. Yeah. I've seen imagery around the drill sites that they, you know, the drill locations that they did.
Yeah.
Just off Kariwe there, so
so do we want to talk about the paddle out on the weekend, and also like it's the latest in like 20 years of opposition being expressed by this community, isn't it?
So there is a paddle out at Manu Bay on Sunday the 8th at 11 a.m. till 1 or 2, I think, everyone that considers the ocean part of their life could is welcome to come and come and join. And
is that Manu Bay, is it?
Paddle out at Manu. It looks, the day doesn't look like too bad a day, so it'll be a nice gathering. There'll be a couple of people speaking. There'll be a little bit of kai there.
Yeah.
So, you know, bring a wetsuit, bring a board, then bring some warm clothes for after.
Yeah, because the weather's getting colder as the week goes on. I saw there was going to be a film screening. Is that still on?
That's potentially a couple of weeks after I was. Yeah, that's when I come back from Europe for this conference. I'll hopefully we'll do a film screening just on the paddle out. It started as an idea just for New Plymouth and Raglan to have a paddle out.
Yeah,
and it spawned into paddle outs in Wellington, Whanganui, Pātia, New Plymouth, Raglan, Port Waikato, and Murawai, all on the same day.
So Wellington and Murawai have been added over the weekend since I last heard.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah. So this is the spring of opposition that's come out of this last phase. I went down to Opanaki back in April, and there was an event there that the local Māori and surf crew there pulled people together for a whole weekend of events, and it was I'd say 500 people sort of across the events engaged. And since then, there's just been like all this activity going on in Taranaki, hui and wānanga, and people going to the council events, and just lots and lots of activity and opposition springing up. So it's really encouraging. I think my sort of longer term view of how this is going to play out is that whether or not TTR gets their consent through the EPA process, through this fast-track process, it will get held up one way or the other in the courts after it. And they won't get a final approval during this term of government. And the election in 18 months will see a flip in government, and because these guys are so unpopular with their radical, crazy behaviour. And then a new government will come in and we'll ban this. We'll get this finally banned. That's sort of the longer term view that I have on it. But we need to sustain the opposition over that time. And I think this spring of opposition, these waves of opposition, there's been in the 20 years that CASM has been around, this is like the third wave of opposition, and they tend to last a few years. So, I'm hopeful, to be honest.
Yeah, well, Shane Jones talking to his base through the media is aggravating people.
It is, and it's just dumb, and it's baseless. He said this bog standard seabed comment last week, and it's just such rubbish. The area that they want to mine, not the direct area of the mine site, but the area surrounding it, is extraordinary. I mean, the direct area is as well, but it's extraordinary. It's unique in New Zealand's landscape and coastal landscape. It's this sort of Goldilocks zone of depth that extends further from shore than anywhere else in the country.
Oh, so there's like a plateau.
So there's
out
a
there.
There's a shelf, or it's a shelf, called the Pātia Shoals, that goes. Yeah. It keeps a 30-meter depth contour out to about 30 kilometers from shore. So it's too far from. It's a good depth for sunlight to get in and have high productivity. But it's far enough from the shoreline where the sedimentation from rivers and so on affects the reefs. So it's got these super vibrant and abundant reef systems that exist out there that simply don't exist anywhere else in the country.
Right, and it's basically protected from, because our rivers will be putting a lot more sediment in the water than they would have pre-European days.
Correct.
When it was mostly forest.
So his comment was rubbish, unscientific, and he's saying let's let the science win. And I'm like, okay, well, if you want to do that, then you've lost, because the science tells us that this is stupid.
So the situation is a little more hopeful than I thought, because the EPA is still involved, and because we know how, I don't know, the idea that it's a good idea to do that is ridiculous. And I'm saying that based on having interviewed scientists like Dougal Greer, interviewed benthic scientists. Mm. And it just, every way you look at it, it's crazy. And I also saw, I was having a go at TVNZ the other day on the air, which, not that they're listening, but they had quote, I think they must have quoted some TTR language, because they described the device that picks up the bits of seafloor as a crawler. Right, and I said, you don't call anything a crawler when it's as big as a house.
Yeah.
And not when it can dig down multiple meters, down to 11 meters, is it? It can
11
dig.
11 meters is what.
Yeah, like that's not a crawler. That's a monster. A more accurate term, if you're looking for a colloquial term, would be a monster.
It's a mining machine. It's just a big machine.
A monstrous machine.
Something like that.
Yeah, it should.
I mean, the industry, they're trying their hardest to soften the language so that people have cleaner pictures of what they want to do.
But what's up with our journalists at TVNZ? Like, why are they busy?
They're not the only one. All journalists kind of are buying the industry language.
Are they so easy to fool? Are journalists that easy to fool?
Some. You tell me. You're one.
I'm not a journalist. I don't identify with that particular group of people who report things so inaccurately.
I think journalists generally do their best, and they try to provide a balanced view.
One thing I will say is, and I feel this too, when I put stuff out, is like, who are you going to piss off when you put out an article or a news item? And I see it with the reporting of when there's a protest. Like, I've been to a protest in Auckland where there were 35,000 people, and one newspaper said 25,000, and another, the Waikato Times, said 11,000 people. And so it's safe to be wrong. It's safe to piss off the crowd that were down there because they're not that powerful.
Mm.
But if you gave a number that was too big, then the actual powerful people, they would be very upset with you. And so I think that has a kind of a swaying effect where the mistakes will always go against the little people, never against the powerful people. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's safe to say crawler. It's not safe to say monstrous machine.
Yeah, no.
You'd be accused of emotive language, even though it's probably correct. It does sum it up quite well. The word monstrous.
I get your point, Aaron.
Yeah, that's why I've been thinking about this, and it's been bugging me again. Yeah. As you can got all animated.
Internationally, the companies call deep sea mining, where they're strip mining vast areas of ocean floor, they're calling it harvesting.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not harvesting. There's no crop next year. You know, that they can come back and harvest the following year. It's these things take millions of years to grow.
Yeah, so, anyway. It was the same thing in like when Israel started calling their settlements neighborhoods.
Yeah,
because people would be like, "Well, what's wrong with a neighborhood? What's wrong with harvesting? What's wrong with a crawler?" Like all these words. Yeah. Anyway, so that's that annoying situation.
Just reminder, folks: Sunday the 8th, Manu Bay. Come along, have fun with the family, and love the ocean.
11 a.m. Mm. Yeah, and a movie coming up maybe a few weeks later.
Yeah.
Okay, and you, where are you heading off to next? Because you're always talk to you between trips, it seems.
Yeah, going to France, the UN Ocean Conference, which is pretty much the biggest international conference on the ocean every 3 years. It starts next week, so I'll be there for 9 days on the ground and engaging with governments around deep sea mining and encouraging governments to call for a pause or a moratorium on the opening of this vast area of the Pacific for deep sea mining.
So, because you come in so often, and I think everyone knows you, I didn't really introduce you properly, I realise. So, who are you representing when you go?
The Deep Sea Conservation Coalition.
Right.
And I also kind of wear my CASM hat as well as a local organisation. But yeah, the DSCC is my main organisation, which is made up of 130 organisations globally.
Yeah.
And we, you know, work to protect the deep ocean.
Right, and you're kind of representing the Pacific area for that organisation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how many countries, because over the last few years I've been talking to you, more and more countries have been stating their opposition to deep sea mining, and is that continuing to grow?
It is, and actually the last UN Ocean Conference was in Lisbon in 2022, and I went to that, and we put on an event with the government of Palau, and they were the first countries to stand up on the global stage and raise their hand and say, we need to put a moratorium on this.
Yeah.
And that was Palau, Fiji and Samoa. And then that week, President Macron flew into Lisbon because he was hosting the next UN Ocean Conference, and he said, look, we should stop deep-sea mining before it starts. And so that week there were 4 countries supporting a moratorium. Now there's 33. And we're hoping that, you know, a couple more might announce their support this week.
Yeah. But we've also got the situation with – I hear Trump saying things. He says a lot of things. Have we got some reliable information about what the US is thinking around the subject?
Yeah, there are some facts that have played out in the last month or so. Donald Trump put out an executive order saying that he wants his government to get ready and go and facilitate mining both in the US waters as well as in international waters beyond their jurisdiction, which is funny because – and he wants them to give consents to mine, both in their territory and outside their territory, through US laws and bypass the international legal framework for... So yeah, I mean, there's... You can draw a line in the ocean. They do draw lines in the ocean, which are artificial lines, but... you know, countries have territories, exclusive economic zones, and then the areas beyond any country's territory is called the high seas or international waters. And there's an international organization called the International Seabed Authority, which administers, you know, any activities in that area beyond.
And we've got a large, like the economic zone, is it 200 Ks?
200 nautical miles, I believe.
Right, but we've got an area in the Pacific where there's no islands, quite a substantial area, and so that's there's a large...
There's a huge... I mean, the area that is beyond country's jurisdiction covers half the planet. This little organisation based in Jamaica that I've attended several times over the last few years and will again in July, that governs half the surface of the planet. Any activities there. So it's kind of important. And that area has been deemed the common heritage of humankind, meaning that you have a stake in it, I have a stake in it, as does every other human on the planet. And Trump has said, we're going to go and mine that area through our laws and screw the rest of the world. So the rest of the world is basically saying, no, that's not okay. That's illegal. That breaks international rules. And you're really mucking with the cooperation that governments have been, you know, been engaging in for several decades. You know, multilateralism is the term used where countries cooperate to try and do things. You know? It's basically the UN framework. You know, and
that's his style to act as dictator of the universe.
That's right.
I nearly said world, but I think universe is more appropriate for his grandiose style. Yeah. It's when you are the number one country, you can kind of get away with that. And the US has always been like that, but they don't usually say it out loud.
But in this context, the US has quietly engaged in the process. They come to the meetings as well. There's a distinction here because the US never signed on to the treaty, the Global Ocean Treaty, and so they feel they're not bound by it, but actually in the way they've been acting, they are bound by it legally. Yeah. Legally, I think most people would agree that they are bound by international laws. So it's a real real shift in the landscape within which we're working. We're trying to work through the International Seabed Authority to have all the countries to agree on a moratorium and stop the process of opening this massive area up, which would cause... like unprecedented damage to our oceans. And so Trump's move, it's purely based on the America First policy that he has, and he's causing a mess globally,
which is his style. Now Daniel's just turned up. Daniel, come up and grab a seat.
More than ever.
you're just in time. He was so keen to listen, he came in the studio. It does happen from time to time. So, Daniel Kiriopa, we were hoping you'd make it into the studio. Morning.
Oh, morena.
I'm just going to shift that mic so I can see Daniel's face. So, have you been out for a surf this morning?
No surfing. Just
Not many people have.
No, just dad's jobs, dropping off. Okay.
Right. So have you been keeping up with the? We've just been talking to Phil about the latest on the seabed mining issue. Have you been keeping up with that in the last few weeks and months?
Yeah. I think. Just as Hokkaido, you're always watching the environment and what's happening anyway, and how it's shifting and how the world forgets about what they actually love and they forget to protect it. So, I've been watching all the things around what Chasm's up to. I think we're just fortunate that Chasm decided to put their voice forward, 20 years ago? About 20 years, right?
20 years.
Yeah.
You know? I couldn't imagine if they didn't decide to make their voice heard, and only Hokkaido was the only ones that could voice their opinions. So having the community behind Chasm and everything they do, plus the Hokkaido, is good for everybody.
So can iwi, we talked about council and iwi down in Taranaki can will probably be able to have their say to the decision making to the EPA. What about up here? Will our hapu be able to participate in that process? Do you know, or do you want to?
I think on the basis of what happens to our rohe and around our coastlines, we do want to have a say. We can never speak on what other hapu are going through.
Yeah.
But the effects of what's going to happen down south will eventually make its way up to where we are in Whangaroa.
Yeah, well, Phil and I have been talking about which council, where their boundaries are. But as people who use the ocean, for both of you, I mean, does the ocean see... how relevant are those boundaries when you're out in the water and you're talking about the ocean?
Yeah.
Like, just because that, you know, like you know, the water, it comes up the coast. And
the animals don't have boundaries, right?
Yeah, you know, yeah.
So the South Taranaki Bight, that area, between the Taranaki coastline and the South Island, that big body of water is is one of the most diverse marine mammal areas in the world, and that's marine mammals that live and exist there and marine mammals that traverse through in their migration patterns. Yeah. So boundaries, they serve our purpose for, you know, sense of ownership or whatever, but there are no boundaries in nature.
Yeah. So Daniel, if you yourself were able to talk to the decision making committee, the EPA, are we calling them the decision making committee?
Yeah,
we are. Yeah, okay. I thought because it's a new process, I wasn't sure. Like, I mean, what would you want to tell them?
You know, I'm not the political type of person that has all the facts and figures and things like that.
Yeah,
I've never sort of had that ability to store that kind of factual information.
Yeah,
so my story would come back to when we were all kids and the affection and love that you have for the ocean. I'd start back there. That's where I'd start my story. And, you know, as you grow up as an adult, you always lean back on those times of memories that you've shared with yourself, with the ocean, with people. And I just said, man, how about cutting that lifeline away from you? Take all that time you've cherished with the water to the child you, and let's just take it away from you. Yeah. You'll have a space where you'll never forget the lovely times you spent with your grandparents, with your father, with your mother, and the people before that came that encouraged that story too. Take that away from you, and you'll figure out that a part of your whole identity is gone. Mm. Gone at not your choice, but someone else's. And do you have the ability to fight for that, to fight for your family? More important, the part that is the ocean is your family. And what words can you express? Some people can only do it by haka, some people do it by other means of media works. But you just have to find your why on how to protect the moana.
Yeah. And so are you encouraging people locally to get in support of this, or is it just happening anyway? No one needs any encouragement?
Oh, we all need encouragement. We all need to remind ourselves why we even came to Whangaroa. You know?
Yeah. Like,
what if the ocean was sick? Would you still come here? What if the waves weren't here? Would you still come here? What is the reason why you wake up to the vibration of this beautiful town?
Yeah.
And you want to fight for that or not?
All right.
Yeah, good. So the paddle out.
Let's just stop it there.
Yeah, I think so. That's what I'm thinking. Like, we'll just remind people when the paddle out is again and the event. And even if you don't go in the water, there's still stuff happening down there at Manu Bay that people can come to.
Sunday the 8th at 11 a.m.
Yeah, and you guys are going to be there. You're back. No, you won't be. No. You're out of the country. Phil's out of the country. You'll be here, DK.
Yeah, I'll be here. There's a few kaupapa going on in Whangaroa that weekend too. So. There's things happening at the Kōkiri Centre as well, some whānau, so it'll be sort of back and forth.
Okay, yeah, awesome. All right, thank you for coming in, both you guys.